Welcome to Enclave on Air. In today's episode, we spoke with Anne Chang, MD, PhD. In our exclusive interview, Dr. Chang reflected on how the field has shifted since the introduction of chemo immunotherapy in 2018, highlighting improvements in median overall survival and the emergence of long-term responders in extensive stage disease. Chang also explored the growing understanding of disease heterogeneity and the evolution of biomarker-informed strategies under evaluation in the Phase 2 S2409 PRISM trial. Additionally, Chang examined the clinical effect of DLL3-targeted therapies, including the recently approved bispecific antibody tarlatamab, and how surface targeting strategies are expanding options beyond traditional chemotherapy. Beyond efficacy, Chang underscored the importance of individualized decision-making by assessing patient fitness beyond ECOG performance status, navigating treatment urgency in rapidly progressive disease, and balancing durability with toxicity when counseling patients on therapy. Small cell lung cancer has historically been viewed as a disease with limited innovation. In your view, are we truly in a different era now, or are we refining margins around the same backbone? How do you frame this reality for patients?
I think we're definitely in another era. You know, if you look at the 5 decades before 2018, we had pretty much 5 major advancements that had to do with our baseline chemotherapy regimen and then use of radiation for prophylactic uses or for thoracic radiation. And now I think since 2018, we've had at least 4 or 5 major advancements in our understanding in biology and new agents that are available for use for our patients. So I think that is a major advance. Before immunotherapy, we unfortunately did not have patients really who were able to have long-term survival. And most of the patients, the median overall survival, unfortunately, was around 9 months. But since that time, and I think we're continuing to advance, our patients typically have median overall survival over a year. And I've honestly had patients with extensive disease who have been free of disease for several years and ongoing. So I think that our advances come from the understanding of small cell and improved tools that really take a new innovative edge towards treating the disease.
Absolutely. That is always very encouraging to hear. Unlike other thoracic malignancies, small cell lung cancer does still lack widely used predictive biomarkers. So are there emerging molecular subtypes or translational signals that you think could realistically influence treatment decisions in the near term?
Yeah, I think that we're learning a lot more about small cell biology and the fact that it's not just one disease or one treatment fits all. There's heterogeneity and we can thus understand the heterogeneity and then target selective therapeutic vulnerabilities. An example of that is the cooperative group trial that I'm national chair on. It's called the S2409 PRISM trial. And we're going to have over 800 patients with extensive stage small cell that we're going to collect tissue from. And based on their molecular subtypes, so for example, if they're subtype A, N, P, or I, and their Schlafen 11 status by IHC, if it's positive or negative, they'll be actually randomized to that biomarker targeted therapy in the maintenance setting versus, you know, maintenance immunotherapy alone. So it's a very exciting trial. I think we're going to learn a lot from it. I think that another approach, and this goes back to the prior question regarding innovation, by understanding that our, you know, standard markers, PD-L1 or tumor mutational burden, have not sort of borne out to be good predictive markers for immunotherapy. New approaches have really just targeted the surfaceome, so proteins on the surface of the cell. An example is DLL3, the bispecific antibody tarlatamab that's been approved. And that basically is an antibody that recognizes DLL3 on the surface of the cancer cell. And it also recognizes CD3, a protein on the surface of a T cell or the immune system. and just acts as a bridge. So it takes the immune system to the tumor cell, and we're, you know, having great response rates of 40%, additional stable disease of 30%. So, you know, somewhere around 70 or above patients are having clinical activity with this agent. And I like to tell my patients, and I remind them that there is no chemotherapy involved in that agent. It's just bringing the immune system to the cancer cells. So that's an example of real innovation that I think has really moved the field forward.
Incredibly exciting. Thank you for calling back to that innovation aspect too, to talk about DLL3. Very exciting stuff and developments, as you said, that we're seeing there. So very important to spotlight. Small cell lung cancer often presents in patients who have, you know, significant comorbidities and performance status challenges. So when thinking about making decisions and selecting treatment for these patients, how do you assess their treatment fitness beyond ECOG? And how does that assessment maybe shift your plan away or towards what guidelines suggest?
Yeah, that's a great question. Certainly, ECOG performance status is a very important measure or metric of assessing the functional status of our patients. If they can independently perform their activities of daily living, how active they are, how symptomatic they are. But as you know, that's not the only metric that we consider as oncologists. We have to think about their bone marrow fitness. For example, have they been heavily pretreated with other chemotherapy regimens? Are they going to be able to respond to the treatment regimen or have significant side effects from that? We also have a range of ages, right? So often there are additional metrics that look at the influence or look at the geriatric population. There's a tool called the CARC tool that looks at, again, some aspects of your bone marrow, but also, you know, how many medications are you taking and how active you are. And different versions of that even look at how, you know, just a simple metric of can you get up very easily from the chair on your own. That also helps us to have a picture of how you're going to do with therapy. The other aspect to consider is that this may change the dynamic changes in our patients over time. So patients, especially if they present with symptoms because of their small cell lung cancer, often even if they have a performance status of 3 or 4, the NCCN guidelines direct us to consider treatment for them because they can often improve with treatment. As you're shrinking the disease, you're improving the symptoms. And I've definitely seen patients who have resumed, almost gone back to their baseline before they had cancer. So I think we have to take all of these into consideration. I think examples of a recent trial that was approved by the FDA is the Imforte regimen that approves lurbinectedin plus atezolizumab in maintenance. And in that trial, the patients who started out with this extensive stage had to have performance status of 0 to 1, which is quite good. And then they went through 4 cycles of chemo plus immunotherapy. And then after the induction phase, they again said, okay, let's see which patients have good performance status. And only those with 0 to 1 were going to randomize to further therapy. And that's because, you know, you're adding additional chemotherapy to the maintenance regimen. And so you want to make sure that, you know, folks who were really beat up by the chemo have a chance to recover. And I think so, again, sort of being cognizant or being aware that there are changes in fitness, sometimes for better, sometimes for worse, and that you really have to continue to see the patient as a, you know, within their context of a holistic context. I would say the last part of that question focuses on other aspects of the patient's environment, right? So it's not only the patient, but do they have caregivers that come with them? Do they live alone? Do they have transportation? Are they able to come back and forth? All of these things really affect their ability to get treatment regimens. In specific, tarlatamab is one where you have pretty high incidence of like 60% of patients will have cytokine release syndrome. And that means that they're either, you know, we usually hospitalize them for the first 22 hours after their first two treatments, because especially if they're living far away, they can't really come in and be treated. They're very good treatments for CRS, and they can get through that pretty easily. But if you're not available, then if you can't get in, then that can certainly affect you. We're doing some pilot studies now. We have a program to try to do that in an outpatient setting for selected low-risk patients. We've kicked it off and it's going well.
Very exciting. Yeah, no, I think that's such a great point to make about really looking at this in totality, the patient's situation, you know, and kind of considering, like you said, the sort of ever-changing nature of disease. You're going to be treating it differently at different points. And I think that lends itself to the next question that we have here. As you know, small cell lung cancer can progress very quickly. So how does the urgency of disease influence your threshold for initiating therapy, modifying doses early, or even foregoing certain diagnostics in order to avoid any delays?
You're absolutely right. Small cell can often progress. A patient with small cell can often present with widespread metastases and symptoms from the disease. And we certainly do see those patients ending up in the hospital, and we will often start chemotherapy at that time for the first cycle. And that helps to achieve cytoreduction to help with the symptoms. I think that after discharge, we can add immunotherapy to the second cycle, or we can add radiation to the second cycle for limited stage disease. Our trial, the PRISM trial, is a pragmatic trial that allows for your first even 1 to 2 cycles of induction therapy to be done off trial, and then you can still go into the trial after that. And I know that several other first-line studies also have allowed that, mainly because of, not only, but certainly because investigators have really acted on behalf of patients to say, look, we think our patients should be able to have access to these really exciting trials, and even if they've had their first cycle of chemotherapy in the hospital. And so many of them are actually starting to be a little bit less restrictive and allow that.
That's always great to hear, actually. And then speaking of the first line, with chemoimmunotherapy now standard in this setting, how do you counsel patients about durability versus toxicity, and are expectations here aligned with what you realistically will see in practice?
I think oncologists have a responsibility to counsel honestly, but also with hope. You know, I think that we all know that the median overall survival is over a population, so each individual patient can do much better or could do much worse than those numbers. And I mentioned those numbers, the median overall survival, but I always tell folks to take that with a grain of salt, because that's not each person is an individual. You know, I think that many of our patients do very well with immunotherapy, many more than in the pre-immunotherapy era. But we are trying to understand how to extend that benefit to more patients. And that's why I encourage them to participate in clinical trials. We're looking at exceptional responders at Yale, and submitted an abstract to ASCO on this. And we do have patients who are with extensive stage who have lived beyond 5 years. And we're really excited to really understand how we can, again, extend that benefit to more patients.
Yeah, absolutely. That would obviously be huge. And as you said, it makes it so much more important to contextualize those statistics based on individual situations, because the number is not always the reality. So certainly very well put. All right, we are at our last question here. So starting to look ahead, if you think about what would truly change the trajectory of small cell lung cancer outcomes over the next 5-ish years, where do you believe the breakthroughs need to come from? For example, you know, novel targets, earlier detection, better supportive care infrastructure, or something else entirely?
This is such an exciting time for small cell. We're seeing breakthroughs in terms of novel targets, either bispecific antibodies that target the tumor surface, or even antibody drug conjugates. that target proteins on the surface of the tumor. It's exciting because we're starting to think about trials that replace components of our standard frontline regimen, such as the platinum doublet. And that was unthinkable in the past. And I think now we're saying, okay, well, if antibody drug conjugates have equal or better response rates in the second line setting than in the first line setting, and if the progression-free status is equal or better, then why don't we use those regimens in the first line? And another example of this is tarlatamab, where there's some early data from the phase one maintenance trial that shows that those patients have a median overall survival of 25 months, which is incredible. So I think those randomized phase three trials are ongoing for maintenance. In other words, adding or utilizing our active agents earlier and earlier in the frontline or in the maintenance setting or in the limited stage setting. So I think those are really going to improve our outcomes. You know, there are such exciting aspects of, again, understanding the biology, such as the PRISM trial, looking at what are differences in if we can, you know, really tailor your treatments to the type of, or the really do precision medicine, if we can tailor treatments to the kind of disease that you have, that's really important. I do think that we should continue to encourage our patients to go for screening earlier. Overall lung screening is for patients who are ages 50 through 80, who've had 20 pack year history. And that I think has really showed that we can detect non-small cell, but I think also we're going to pick up small cells as well at a time when you can potentially have surgery and be cured and not even have to go through radiation or the combination chemo plus radiation. So, you know, I think all of these advancements are working. And the other last thing that I would mention is that one of my fellows, Xiaowang, did an article with me for the ASCO education book. And we did an interview with several of our patients asking them, how would you like doctors to talk to you? Or what would you like to talk about with your caregiver, with your doctor or your nurse practitioner? And they said that they wanted to talk about prognosis, that they wanted to talk about expectations, whether or not there was the possibility of good prognosis, but also understanding the possibility of poor prognosis, and that they felt that, you know, if they were in a regimen that was for limited stage, where it is curative intent, it was helpful for them to know that, so that would take them through the sort of increased toxicity or hard parts of what they were going through, and vice versa for extensive stage. They understand that everybody's trying for the best outcome, but they needed to know that, you know, at some time in the history of the disease, patients may not do as well. It may not make sense to keep going on with therapy. And it's important to have a trusting relationship with your doctor who can say to you, you know, we've talked about this and unfortunately we're in a different place now. And that was really helpful for them to be able to have those conversations, even though they were really difficult. So I think we also have room to move in terms of supporting our patients. But I do think it's a super exciting time for small cell, and we're really going to knock down some barriers and make some progress here.
Very exciting to hear. Yeah, I think that is such a interesting, you know, addendum to all of these points about, you know, the rapid developments that are happening every day, that's centering the patients in these conversations, you know, allowing them to really make informed decisions. I feel like, you know, we hear every day that there's all this progress and it's so exciting, but really being able to know how does that impact, you know, them and their unique situation. When we have all these conversations about individualizing therapy, that is so much a part of it. So love that that's been addressed. Really, really great research there. Thank you for spotlighting it. That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of Onclive on Air. Check back throughout the week for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OnClive is also on social media. On X and Blue Sky, follow us at OnClive. On Facebook, like us at OnClive and follow our OnClive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OnClive on Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OnClive on Air.